yes, welcome back, those of you who were here yesterday, but I'm assuming most of you were not, so I won't assume too much knowledge. And welcome to Oxford, those of you who are new to Oxford. I'm going to be talking about reproducibility, which is... that shouldn't have happened, never mind. It's a question of what is the reproducibility crisis, that's better. And the issue is that some people think there is no crisis. Some people have not even heard of the idea of there being a crisis. Other people think of it as a serious crisis. Increasingly, and yesterday we had a whole satellite meeting on reproducibility, people are putting up slides like this that illustrate findings from many different areas, including psychology, but not restricted to psychology, also including mainstream medicine, pharmacy, pharmaceuticals, and other areas, biomedical research, where there's a suspicion that a lot of research funding is being wasted because the results that are coming out are simply not solid and reproducible. And what I want to do today is to discuss not so much trying to give you the evidence for that, because you can read that elsewhere, but to sort of talk about what we might possibly do about it. That's better. My slides were going a bit weird earlier on, but that's fine. So the question is, what is the solution if we do have a problem? And 3 years ago now, the Academy of Medical Sciences, together with both the Medical Research Council, BBSRC, and Wellcome Trust, ran a meeting, a two-day symposium on this topic, which I chaired, and which came to the conclusion that there was no one solution. The problems were multiple, and the ways we might solve them were multiple, but that there were issues that needed to be addressed by researchers themselves, by journals, institutions, and funders. And in a longer version of this talk, I actually talk about the journals, institutions, and funders and what they should be doing. But today, in 30 minutes, I'm going to focus on researchers, because that's who you are. But just to say that a lot of the problems we got, we think, are due to problems with the incentive structures that have existed, but that it's important for you to recognise that there really is big change coming to that. And so sometimes people think, well, if I behave and do things that Dorothy recommends that I should do to do reproducible research, my career is doomed. I think that's very far from being the case. And in particular, the fact that funders like the Wellcome Trust and Research Councils are beginning to take reproducibility seriously, the fact that in the next Research Excellence Framework exercise, reproducibility of and sort of robustness of research is going to be taken seriously, are things that are going to make these incentive structures change quite radically. But let's look at this theoretical possibility. Let's suppose you're reviewing a paper for Current Biology, and it's looking at the effects of computer games on dyslexia. And you have to just have a think, if you were going to... Now, obviously, there's loads of things about the paper you would take into consideration, but if all else was equal and it had 20 participants and it found that the intervention had a beneficial effect, p less than 0.05, and I should say I'm going to be talking about p-values today. I know many people are Bayesians and think this is a whole nonsense, but most people are still using p-values, so that's what I'm going to focus on. But suppose you found that. Would you be more likely to accept that paper than if you had a study with 20 participants and no significant difference between the groups? I think most of us can agree that the first type of study is much more likely to be accepted. Some journals are very explicit that they're not very interested in null results. And indeed, such a paper was accepted, and I got irritated by it and blogged about it. I tend to blog when I get irritated. But this is really the sort of situation where we end up with studies getting into the literature on the basis of the results rather than on the basis of the calibre of the research design and the methods and so on. And the problem with this study really is going to be that it's got low power, which is one of the many problems that pervade certainly psychology and neuroscience and many other areas. That is to say, with 20 subjects, that's 10 per group, you've got a very high chance that if you get a significant result, it is actually a false positive. And this was recognised ages ago. This historical line is not going to actually go in order because this talk has been shuffled, but I'm showing you here that back in 1987, statistician Newcomb, talking more about medical findings and trials, just said that small studies continue to be carried out with little more than blind hope of showing the desired effect. But papers based on such work are submitted for publication, especially if the results turn out to be statistically significant. The point being that if you have this very small sample and you show nothing, everybody says, well, of course you haven't found anything, you're underpowered. But if you then say, well, we're going to publish it if it does find something, you end up with this difficult situation. What about if this study then had 200 participants and didn't find anything? Would you publish it? Would you recommend it? Would it be more likely to be recommended than the one with 20 participants and a significant result? Analysis of what does and doesn't get published suggests that actually, even with 200 participants and a really well-powered design, this study would probably also be rejected by a lot of top journals the reviewers would say, well, that's not terribly surprising. We didn't really think that computer games would affect dyslexia anyway. So again, you've got this asymmetry, which leads to this phenomenon of publication bias, which again has been talked about for years. It's been talked about in the 1975 by Greenwald, and 1979 Rosenthal talked about the file drawer problem, which is you do a study and you don't get a significant result. What do? You put it in your file drawer. And we've all got file drawers full of studies that never got published, either because we didn't even bother to write them up and submit them for publication because we thought nobody would be interested, or because nobody was interested if we did go to all that effort. And in fact, Greenwald talked about prejudice against the null. In some areas of behavioural science research, the research publication system may be regarded as a device for systematically generating and propagating anecdotal information. That's putting it pretty hard. But even though he was saying this in 1979, this hasn't really changed very much. It's mainly been impacted by people in the field of medicine, where if you get these things wrong, people may die, because the problem with publication bias, if you're doing trials of drugs, for example, is that you will end up with a literature full of positive findings about a particular drug, nobody publishing their null results. And this is something that the medical profession, I know, is very keen to tackle, because it really does mean that you've got a completely false impression of what's effective. But some people say, well, psychology, it's not so high stakes, it doesn't matter if this happens. Well, I would argue it does, because it means that then people waste time trying to follow up ideas that haven't actually got anything going for them, and we waste a lot of research funding. So, let's have another anecdote or sort of theoretical scenario. You're running a study investigating a drug, X, and whether it affects anxiety. And you look in the data and you find the effects are much bigger in people aged under 25. So you hadn't anticipated that, but it looks really interesting. It's highly significant in under 25. There's nothing on older people. What should you do? Should you say, at this, when you write up the paper, we tested whether this drug affected anxiety, which is what you actually did? Or should you say, we tested whether age has an effect on the impact of X on anxiety, which would fit more with what you found? The latter is what an awful lot of people would do, and it's an absolute no-no for reasons that will become clear. But this was described back in 1998 as harking, hypothesizing after the results are known, by a man from the splendid name Norbert L. Kerr. And he pointed out how this distorts the literature again, because when you're interpreting statistical findings, it means that you are behaving as if you predicted this and interpreting your statistics in that sort of way, when in fact you didn't. Now, this is universal, I find, in many fields of psychology, certainly, and there's a good reason why it is. It was explicitly advocated in a very major and important place. There's a book called The Complete Academic that has gone through several editions, which includes an article by the very eminent Darrell J. Bem. And what does Bem say? He says, you should hark. So he says, what article should you write? There's two possible articles, the article you planned to write when you designed your study, or the article that made most sense now you've seen the results. They're rarely the same, and the correct answer is B. That's telling you that you should hark. And then in the data analysis, it gets even better. Examine your data from every angle. Analyze the sexes separately. Make up new composite indices. If a datum suggests a new hypothesis, try to find additional evidence elsewhere in the data. If you see dim traces of interesting patterns, try to reorganize the data to bring them into bolder relief. If there's participants you don't like, or trials, or observers, or interviewers who give you anomalous results, drop them temporarily. Go on a fishing expedition. Now, this is incredibly bad advice that no statistician would ever accept. But this was influential, and I remember reading this when I was quite junior, because this was a second edition, there was a first edition when I was still quite young, and thinking, oh, this is weird, you know, is this what I should be doing? And we're told on the blurb at the back that this book provides invaluable guidance that will help you academics plan, play, and ultimately win the academic career game. I think this is the problem, that if people are thinking of this as a game that you win, rather than trying to find out the truth about what's going on, this is what you do. But it's really problematic. Let's move on to a related issue. So this is a correlation matrix, and it's from a study that measured various perceptual skills in relation to reading ability in children. And what we have here is two auditory tests, two visual tests, an auditory visual test, a reading measure, and a spelling measure. And we have a correlation matrix. And as you see, highlighted not just with stars, but in red, so you really can't miss it, I have put the two correlations that, with a sample of 30, would be statistically significant at 0.05, and in one case, 0.01. Now, how would we interpret or report results from this? This is the sort of data that I see regularly presented in talks in my area, and what people typically do is to say, well, this is really interesting. Why is there a selective relationship between these auditory measures and reading? And they go on to interpret that and go all sort of around of why they get this correlation and not that. These data were generated by me from simulated data that was simulated to be completely random. And the script, if you don't believe me, you can play with it and run it and run it, and every run, you typically see some significant correlations. Why? It's because we're not looking at a single correlation, we're looking at a whole set of them. And if you have enough of them, something is going to pop up as significant by chance. It won't be the same one on every run, it will vary from run to run. So if you see something like this, what you should be saying to yourself is not, I'm going to interpret that amazing p-value because it's so exciting. If you hadn't predicted it in advance, what you should be saying is, I better replicate this and see if it comes out in another sample. This is exploratory, it's not hypothesis testing. But we're treating those p-values as if we're testing a hypothesis a lot of the time when we're really exploring our data. And it's that distinction that people are really failing to grapple with. And it's creating havoc in the field. And it's creating a huge risk of type 1 error, which is best remembered by this wonderful slide showing either you're pregnant or you're not pregnant. Basically, a false positive is a type 1 error when you think you've got something but you haven't. And the easiest way to get those is what's known as p-hacking, which is to look at a whole set of p-values and look for the ones that are significant and then proceed to interpret them. You can, of course, and the more sophisticated of you will be aware that there's things that you can do in terms of correcting for the number of comparisons you're doing. Things like the Bonferroni correction are recommended. People are very resistant to doing that, but sometimes journal editors make them do it. And they should in a situation like this, there's no question about it. But it gets beyond that. It's not just a question of having a big matrix of numbers. There's often flexibility that is not so obvious to people, and they really are unaware of how far they are in effect p-hacking. So there was a nice paper written by Simmons and colleagues on false positive psychology, which explained how you can be very flexible in how you do your data analysis, making a lot of little decisions about who to include, who to exclude, perhaps creating composite variables, doing all the things that, in fact, BEM suggested you should do. And at the end, you forget all the little paths that you didn't take, and you can end up thinking you've got a real result. And he shows in this study that they did some hilarious thing like listening to some song by the Beatles makes you younger, because if you take age as a dependent measure, you could actually tweak your data so that this actually seemed to happen. So you can show almost anything. And this is a big issue that we really need to address in the field. It's part of the garden of forking paths, which is this wonderful analogy that Andrew Gelman drew from a short story by Borgeff, who talked about life being taking one direction or the other through this garden of forking paths. And in this short story, you could take one path or another, and you know, your future is completely different depending on what you do. But this forking paths analogy is useful for describing what people often do when they analyse data. So if you take an area, again, of interest to me, whether handedness is related to attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, for instance. Let's suppose we've got a nice big sample of data and we decide to investigate this question, and we just look at handedness in two groups, ADHD or not. At that point, we find nothing, and we're a bit sad. But there's nothing significant at 0.05, so we think, But what we then do is think, well, let's have a look at it a bit more closely. There might be something going on after all. We look at the younger children, and yes, there does appear to be a hint of something on the horizon. So we go down that path, and then we think, well, in addition, we have two measures of handedness. We have a measure of hand relative hand skill and a measure of hand preference. On the skill measure, this is looking really quite interesting, as if it's nudging towards significance. And then we decide that, yes, in females, it's really looking good. And then we make a decision, a distinction between urban and rural children. And by the time we get down here, we've got P less than 0.05, and we rejoice. And we report this result and say, my goodness, in young urban females on a measure of hand skill, we have a significant result. Except that by the time we've got down there, this actual likelihood of finding a p-value of that level is up to 0.56, because it's continually increasing, because you're actually having to take into account the context in which that p-value occurs. You should be evaluating it against all these ends of all these forking paths, in effect. That is the issue, and that is the issue that many people do not grasp. They see a low p-value and they think it's meaningful in its own right. You have to take the context into account and all the potential comparisons. This is beautifully described back in 1956 by de Groot, who was a very famous psychologist and chess player. And he discussed how people are not using interpreting statistics correctly because they're not distinguishing between hypothesis testing and hypothesis generating research. And if you're looking at your data for anything that might be interesting, that's well worth doing. There may well be something interesting there. He's not saying you shouldn't do exploratory research, but he is saying you can't interpret statistical tests in the same way if you haven't taken into account that context. And therefore, this is really getting at the heart of p-hacking. De Groot was actually largely ignored because he wrote in Dutch, but he was translated a couple of years ago by E.J. Wagenmakers, and that article is still very well worth reading. It really explains the problem. So we have this sort of situation, I think, in psychology and neuroscience, where we have the four horsemen of what I call the reproducibility apocalypse affecting our results. There's harking, there's low power, there's p-hacking, and there's publication bias. So the question is, what are we going to do about this? It's all very well me sort of pulling my hair out and worrying about these horsemen coming for us. I think there are things that we can do to overcome some of these problems, but at the moment, we're at a very interesting point in the development of our science, in that many senior people of my generation don't know about this at all, aren't interested in it, and the people who are pushing for change are the early career people. So it's really quite important, I think, to sort of get people on side. If we're going to bring about change, I think it's more going to come from the bottom up, although I'm really hoping that we can also get some influences from the senior people in due course. But what can we do? Well, the first thing really refers back to the example I gave you before, where I used simulated data to help me understand about the statistics I was using. I'm doing this almost all the time, particularly when you have more complicated designs, where it's not so clear-cut how having several variables might affect your results, or if you've got correlated variables and so on. Simulating data is actually a very good way of getting an insight into how your analysis is affected. And in fact, this early blog, I think I did some simulations even in Excel in those days, and you can play about in Excel and get some quite interesting things going on. And I did this because I was getting puzzled at the high rate I seemed to be able to get significant results out of ERP experiments, that's electrophysiological measures of brain activity, where you're averaging across repeated trials of things like presenting somebody with tones. Now, in this field, it's very common to have many, many levels that you look at. And there's, on the one hand, there's a huge potential for flexibility in how you analyse your data. You've typically got a whole load of electrodes that you're measuring from. You may be looking at different time intervals. This is an averaged waveform. And you're looking at perhaps frequency bands of activity, or you may be measuring peaks. There's many, many things you can be looking at. And this in its own creates problems at the flexibility. But in addition, we have the difficulty that how do people analyse this? They often use multi-way analysis of variance in a rather exploratory fashion. So you throw all these things into your analysis and then you look for significant results. Now, what I hadn't realised until I did simulations is that standard statistical packages will give you some correction in an ANOVA for the number of levels of a factor. So if you've got six electrodes, you don't need to worry whether you have six electrodes, two electrodes. If you're using electrodes as a factor, ANOVA adjusts for that, and so you don't have to do bond for any corrections on that. It does not adjust for the number of factors and interactions between factors that you put into your analysis. I was horrified. I had always assumed it did. It doesn't. And the way I found that out was by running a simulation. So I just simulated a whole load of random numbers. Again, I'm very good at simulating random numbers. I've got superb at it. And I then just allocated them to being different things entered into a classic ANOVA. And what did I find? Well, these are the runs going down here from the, here. Each run has all the p-values from one ANOVA on, based on random data. And what you see is I've got here four different factors. So I've got two groups, two tasks, two sides of the head, probably four locations, that doesn't matter. And then we've got interactions between two-way interactions between these. So we might be looking for, does task vary across group? Three-way interactions and one four-way interaction. That's a total, I think, of 15 different comparisons. The probability of finding something significant by chance for any one of these is 0.05. So if you've got 15 of them, the probability of finding something is incredibly high. And as you go down here, you see on each run, sometimes you find something, sometimes you don't, sometimes you find two significant results. The key point is that on any one of these, it's kept at about 0.05, one in 20 chance of finding something. It varies a bit here just because of slop, because I've only got a few trials I'm showing you. And also, I mean, if I were to say in advance, what I'm predicting is this one, I have guarded in advance that this is what I'm going to test. And if that comes out at 0.05, that's of interest, that's fine. But if I'm just saying I'm going to look at my ANOVA output, and if it's significant, I'm interested in it, and I'm going to write it up as if it's exciting, I'm in big, big trouble. Most people in the field of ERP do exactly that. And in fact, there was a paper just last year by Steve Luck describing this phenomenon and expressing huge concern. There's a massive literature where people have been doing this. So, it's stopped advancing. The computer is so amazed by this result that it's stopped going forward. It seems to be... It's frozen. That's the one, yeah. Thank you. Right. So one thing you can do if you're running a study, and what I recommend to everyone is to sort of really do this thing of generate... data where there's no effect of the kind that you think you're going to investigate and run your analysis on it, and you'll get a sense of how likely you are to fool yourself into thinking you've got getting a result. The more standard way of dealing with problems, which is adopted in genetics in particular, where this was a massive problem because they had so many genetic variants that people could look at that they were finding their literature was filling up with non-replicable spurious results, is that they now, typically you can't get published in a reputable genetics journal unless you have a replication. So that's the alternative, that you use, you take the sample and you look for anything you can find in it, but that's your exploratory phase. But then you do it again, and you see, can I replicate what I found before? And if you can, then you're in business. So that allows you to combine an exploration phase with a replication phase. And this is just standard, as I say, now in genetics, that people are expected to do this and won't get published unless they do. In some fields of psychology, this is easier than others. I appreciate that. In my field, it's really hard. It may take us 3 years to recruit a sample of children to study, and to replicate would be difficult if we had to do it again. So one impact of this is that people start collaborating more and realizing that it's perhaps a good idea to have two labs both trying to find out the same thing, and that might have benefits for everyone. Then finally, the third thing that you can do, which Chris Chambers talked about yesterday, is to put your, nail your colours to the mast when you do your study in making clear what your hypothesis is. Not just so that other people won't accuse you of tweaking your results in, after the event, but to, so you don't fool yourself. Those of us who have done pre-registration have often found that we thought that we had predicted something when we've seen the data, only to go back and find that, no, we hadn't actually. So it's a very interesting business doing this pre-registration. Let me just explain how it works. If you do the sort of registered report that Chris Chambers introduced in Cortex and is now quite widespread elsewhere, it's a change from classic publishing. So with classic publishing, we start with starting by planning a study. We then do the study. We then write it up and submit it to a journal. We then get it reviewed. And at this point, we're in the lap of the gods because we can go round and round and round and round and round that loop for a year or two if we're unlucky. But it, hopefully, eventually, we emerge from the loop and publish the paper. We sometimes don't, because sometimes at this point the reviewer discovers a fatal flaw and then all of this is wasted. So with registered reports, all you're doing really, I mean, Chris Chambers has got a load of slides on this on Open Science Framework that you can look at, but that explain it in detail, but all you're doing is really moving that so that instead of doing the study and then submitting for publication, you plan your study, you submit it to a journal in plan form, which has to be pretty detailed. It has to say exactly what you're going to do, what your predictions are, and it has to be adequately powered, because they're not going to be interested in something that isn't adequately powered. It then gets reviewed, and again, you can go round and round this loop with the reviewers, but at least at this point, you can respond to reviewers by changing your study. Now, I've been through this twice, so I'm sort of one and a half way, I've done it once completely, and we're halfway through with another study. And it's really useful because you get the reviewer feedback at the point when you can do something about it. Being told that you should have done your study differently is very galling when you can't do it differently. But at this point, you can modify the study and improve it, usually, on the basis of reviewer comments. Then it's accepted in principle if you do what you said you were going to do and you do the study and then you publish the paper. So you still have the sort of delay bit, but the delay bit is moved forward, and this makes people very nervous about doing this because they worry that they're not getting on with data collection. But actually, it saves you a huge amount of time at this point. That can sometimes be difficult to achieve if you really haven't got, you know, if you've got something, a short project. I've started now, if I supervise master's projects, of doing what I call pre-registration light through the Open Science Framework, which again is similar to registered reports, but without the reviewer. But you still plan your study and you submit onto this website where it will be date stamped what you have predicted, what you're going to do, and you then have that sort of record of what you planned so that you don't either fool yourself or other people about what you planned. Furthermore, they're so keen in Open Science Framework to get people to do this that at the moment it's possible to earn $1,000 from them if you do this and the paper is then published in a reputable journal, which is nice. And I have one postdoc who's done that. And we haven't yet gone out for the drinks that we planned to go out for, having done it. So I'm just going to finish with a few recommendations because I'm scooting over a load of stuff. There's tons to read about this that's available on the web. There's a very nice lecture that really covers a lot of this by John Ioannidis, who's the sort of, you know, the main man in the field of reproducibility. This I strongly recommend to anyone who wants to really understand more about the underlying philosophy, really, of some of the statistics we do, but it's a very accessible, nice, free Coursera lecture by this guy, Dan Larkins, called Improving Your Statistical Inferences, with lots of little exercises and things that you can do, and you can even win a certificate at the end. And then finally, just sort of more general references, there's a lot of stuff I've got up on SlideShare about references and slides on these issues. This is an overview by a number of people who have been speaking in our events, including me, which outlines a lot of the issues that, and what we think are the solutions. And then two books that I think are really excellent on this topic. Chris Chambers has got this book on the seven deadly sins of psychology, covering a lot of the material I've been talking about. And then Stan Luzzick, more for lab-based scientists and those working with animals, has got, a lot of what he says is also relevant to people working in psychology and human neuroscience. But he talks about how you can design your study to minimize all these effects that might make it non-reproducible. But that's it, thanks.